Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, September 2nd. I'm Sarah Langs from MLB.com. You hear me on the numbers game a lot, and I'm really thrilled to be here hosting in place of Buster today. Lot of fun games in baseball on Tuesday night, as always, but most likely highlighted by not just Alex Dickerson, but all of the offense that the Giants put up in Colorado.
Now there's a swing and a drive to deep left field. Way back there, still going. And goodbye! It's the third home run of the game for Alex Dickerson. This one, an opposite field, Coors Field kind of a homer. And a man who had never hit more than one home run in a big league game has now hit three in this one.
That was Alex Dickerson, as John Miller said, his third homer of the game. He got two chances at a fourth home run. His ninth inning double went 414 feet. It would have been a home run in 29 major league ballparks. Everybody, everywhere but Coors Field. He had a franchise record 5 extra base hits, and that highlight courtesy of KNBR Radio. Now, over in a game that had a little bit of a rain delay, we had some action between the Indians and the Royals.
It's swung on, a little looper towards center. It's going to get down. That's a base hit. Around third, coming home to score is Reyes, and Josh Naylor delivers. An RBI single to center. He has a two-hit game. And the quickest way you can feel comfortable with a new ball club is deliver. And Naylor has done that tonight. And the Indians have scored twice here in the seventh inning. And they now lead the Kansas City Royals 8-1. Now the 1-1 pitch. A swing and a shot toward right. And it is a fair ball. Ricochets into the right field corner. Naylor hits third. He's going to try to score. Here's the throw to the plate. Head first slide. He's in safely. And an RBI double down the right field line by Roberto Perez makes it a 9-1 Indians lead.
That was new acquisition Josh Naylor with a little RBI single, in his first game with the Indians after coming over from the Padres at the trade deadline. And Roberto Perez, 10 runs for the Indians in a much needed offensive outburst for them. That highlight courtesy of WTAM 100. Over in Texas, there were some extra innings between the Rangers and the Astros.
Joey looks to bunt and bunts it out between the mound and the plate, picked up by Maldonado. He throws it past Gurriel down the line. Kiner Falefa digging for third base. He'll try to score. Here comes the throw. He slides. He scores. Rangers get an additional run here and lead 6-4.
That game ending in the 10th inning, 6-4 Rangers. Carlos Correa ending his franchise record errorless streak at shortstop at 90 games with his 10th inning miscue. That highlight courtesy of 105.3, The Fan. Now, over in Boston, the Red Sox continued to struggle a bit with the pitching.
Two runs are in, 4 straight hits for the Braves. And Ozuna crushes one to straightaway center field. Does he have 3? He does! A monster bomb to straightaway center. It's a 3-run shot, his 3rd home run in this game. And the Braves have broken this one wide open. 10-2 Atlanta.
Marcell Ozuna's 3-homer game was the 15th time that a visitor hit 3 home runs in a game at Fenway Park, and the first National League year to do it in a pretty small sample size. That game ended 10-3 Braves. That highlight courtesy of 680, The Fan. Over in Minnesota, the AL Central continued to be neck and neck.
And the pitch, line to left field, a base hit. Near the line, Nelly around third. He will head home. He will score. Buxton, welcome back with the bat. And the Twins take a 3-2 lead here in the 7th.
Byron Buxton already an impact in his first game off the injured list. An outstanding catch to rob a home run from Edwin Encarnacion earlier in the game. And then this go-ahead hit, as the announcer was mentioning, RBI single in the 7th inning. The Twins won 3-2 over the White Sox. That highlight courtesy of Treasure Island Baseball Network. Over in Philly, the Phillies continued to roll a bit with a shutout win over the Nationals.
Finnegan with the pitch. Swung on, belted. Way back to left, forget about it. Long gone, Andrew McCutchen. A 3-run home run to break this one wide open. Sitting on a 3-1 pitch, he crushes it to left. It's his 5th home run of the season, and the Phillies now lead it 6-0.
No doubt about that one. Mercy.
McCutchen continues to have an impact out of the leadoff spot for the Phillies, who won 6-0, 8 scoreless from Aaron Nola as they continue to make their playoff push. That highlight courtesy of 94 WIP. And to wrap it up, we have a new player for the Marlins make an impact in Miami.
Winona Marte is hit high and deep to left center field. Way back, Gurriel at the wall. Goodbye in his first game as a Marlin. Starling Marte, a go-ahead home run in the bottom of the eighth, and it's 3-2 Miami. That's his third of the year, RBI number 15. The trade deadline pickup makes an immediate impact for the Marlins. Welcome to Miami.
Starling Marte helping the Marlins offense from his first game, helping them win that one 3-2. That highlight courtesy of 940 WINZ. Before we get to Mandy and Carl, the NBA playoffs are in full swing. We had a great game 7 last night between the Jazz and the Nuggets. Tonight, the Rockets and Thunder fight for the right to play the Lakers in the second round. An ESPN stable of NBA podcasts will be along for the ride, inside and outside the bubble, until the Larry O'Brien trophy is lifted. You can listen to the Hoop Collective with Brian Windhorst, the Woj Pod, and the Low Post wherever you get your podcasts.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11 ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live.
All aboard, it's the Rabbit Train with Carl Ravitch.
I am honored now to be joined by Carl Ravitch of ESPN Baseball Tonight. All of the great games he calls, everything else he does for ESPN. Carl, how you doing?
This is great. This is an honor for me. I mean, this is like seeing the tree that you plant grow from sapling all the way to a booming maple. The evolution of Sarah Lang's now actually on the Rabby train, which is such a great, I'm glad to have you driving along with us. This is great.
Well, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate that. This is a lot of fun for me. I'm so excited. So let's get into it. So the first thing I thought we could talk about here is the American League East. Obviously, we've seen how the Yankees have played against the Rays this year. They did win last night, and we'll get into a little bit more about that specific game. But I know you and I were talking about the other day just how the Yankees have looked overall against the Rays compared to everybody else. How do we think this is going? Can the Yankees win this division?
If they get healthy, I think they could win the division. I think they're a more talented team, but when you get into the psychological aspect of the head-to-head competition, you remove anybody from being in the stands at Yankee Stadium. I think they're on equal footing. And I do think that there's a psychological component to it in the Rays' advantage that allows them maybe not to have all the talent. They certainly don't have the payroll. They don't have the names that people recognize now. But like Brandon Lau would probably be, I don't know what, the sixth most popular or well-known name on the Yankees, maybe even lower than that. So, yeah, there is a psychological effect that they bring with them when they play them. I don't necessarily know that the Yankees look at it that way, but if I wear that Ray uniform, somehow walking into that clubhouse that day against the Yankees, it feels like they've convinced themselves. Not a problem. It doesn't matter that they're New York. It doesn't matter that they have those names, Judge and Stanton and Chapman and Cole. We're good. We've beaten them. We've lost now, I think, twice all year. Mm-hmm. Not a problem. So, you know, there are other advantages like that, or at least teams that you would look at and think, well, they're way better, but that other team is in their head. The Rays are in the Rays' head. I don't think the Rays are in the Yankee head, to be honest with you, but the Rays are in their own head that they've convinced themselves we are as good, if not better, than the Yankees, in spite of what everybody predicted at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, and I mean, there's no more important team to think you're better than, I think, in Major League Baseball, probably just in history, than convincing yourself that you are better than the Yankees. But I like the way you word it, that they're in their head, because I think that gets a lot towards what we saw happen after the game last night. So after the game, there were some benches clearing. There was an Aroldis Chapman throw to Mike Brasso in the ninth that was very close to his head. He had to duck out of the way. He completed the at-bat. He looked very unfazed, which I was impressed by, a little bit separate. There were some comments by Kevin Cash after the game alluding to poor coaching. There were some names mentioned. Phil Nevin, the third base coach, came up. I believe Kevin Kiermaier said something as well. What seems to be going on with these two teams? Maybe a little bit off the field or more kind of in the chirping area.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was interesting. And I'm sure, you know, knowing that you sleep 45 minutes per night, you know all the sound that was gathered by the reporters. I found the most interesting clip to be Kevin Cash acknowledging that the only pitch ever thrown with intent was 3 years ago. And it was a pitch that was up and it was near ahead. The acknowledgement that that actually was with intent 3 years ago is something you never hear. And on one hand, you'd like to, you know, thank somebody for being so honest and authentic. And on the other hand, you're acknowledging that you threw at somebody high and tight in the head area on purpose. I'm not sure that I've ever heard that, Sarah, from somebody, let alone a manager, acknowledging that even if the Yankees never acknowledge it, or 20 years from now, Aaron Boone and I are on a golf course, and I, for some amazing reason, remember the incident against the Rays where Chapman threw at Brasso's head. Was that intentional? Yeah, we did that with intent. Like, that's I don't see that ever being a part of a conversation. I think that a lot of times when you talk about these teams and you talk about individuals, I think Phil Nevin is one of those guys that when he's on your team, you love him. And when he's not, he can rub you the wrong way. If Aaron Boone thinks Phil Nevin is an asset, and I have such great respect and like for Aaron Boone, then Phil Nevin's a Yankee, and I have all the respect in the world for that decision. But I do know from a Rays perspective that he may be the source of some of the comments, some of the chirping you talk about. They may think that he's the guy who's giving directives on when to throw in and when to throw up. That's really hard. Unless you're in the room, it's impossible to know. But that's the guy that they seemingly have targeted. And to Booney's point after the game, Cash and I have a great, you know, relationship. And if we need to talk, we will. And, you know, Aaron, like I do, he's a guy that is going to be upfront. We're going to have a conversation. We'll do it face to face and we'll move forward. I don't think this is a personal thing between those two. I think there's some personal things between others.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that all sounds absolutely right. Makes a ton of sense to me. I agree that it was really fascinating to hear the quote, or to read the quote from Kevin Cash saying, other than 3 years ago, nobody's hit anybody on purpose. I mean, you don't ever hear that. I think that this is completely offhand, but I'm pretty sure that people have asked Pedro Martinez about some specific pitches, like on MLB Network before, and he still stands by. No, none of those were on purpose. You know,
I never threw at Kareem Garcia. That wasn't intentional. I never did that. Is that what Pedro likes to say?
Something along those lines, right?
But that's
and I
the point,
feel
right,
like,
Sarah?
Yeah,
you can look at it, and I guarantee you this, Tanaka will tell you that the pitch to Joey Wendell, or the two, they got away. That wasn't like, no one admits it. No one acknowledges that. So I'm not surprised by the lack of of acknowledgement. I am shocked when someone says that. But again, that's, to me, speaks to Kevin Cash. Like, look, I'm not a guy that, in my impression and my dealings with Cash over the years, he's going to tell you like it is. There's some Terry Francona stuff in there. He's going to tell you like it is, whether you like it or not. And that was a bold admission. I've just not been exposed to that before.
Yeah.
I mean, that, 3 years ago, you say it, that's a fine, that's a suspension. Did you throw intentionally? Yes, we did. Okay. That's, now we got a problem.
Yeah. It's completely different when it's, denied or not addressed. And then all of a sudden it comes out. Right. And these teams have been hitting each other a lot. The Rays have hit the Yankees 14 times since 2018, and the Yankees have hit the Rays 19 times. I don't, that's a lot of hit by pitches. There's clearly something here. So should be really interesting to see what happens tonight and that continuing. But ultimately, the game on the field, the Yankees are 2-7 against the Rays and 18-7 against everybody else. So it's the same number of losses against every other team they've played this year and the Rays.
Right.
We'll see if they get healthy, if they can, find a way to come back. 3.5 games is certainly a comebackable kind of a deficit, but it's getting late pretty quickly here. Another division I want to talk to you about, NL East, staying in the East. I know that you were talking on the Baseball Night Trade Deadline show and a couple different broadcasts lately about how the Phillies really seem to be on the cusp here. They're 16 and 15, they have the same record as the Marlins right now, which is still a thing. And the Braves have a 3-game lead in the division over both of those teams. But it just feels like the Phillies are right about to be really good here. And the bullpen is that question. So how are you feeling about their chances, the playoffs, potentially that first spot in the division?
I like them a lot. They've been tremendous underachievers, but there was a real lack of consistency from people like Rhys Hoskins, who seemingly has discovered his hitting stroke. And for a while, he was an all-star. He was a home run derby guy. He is capable of very good things. And he just kind of fell apart. And now all of a sudden, Rhys Hoskins is hitting again. Harper is having a 2015 season again. They have good pitching. Their bullpen has been brutal, and they attempted to address it. There was an acknowledgement that we've got all this talent. We're paying all this money. We have a guy that we probably won't be able to retain in JT Realmuto, especially if Stevie Cohen ends up getting the Mets. You can imagine that a guy like that with all that money and a backstop like Realmuto in New York makes a great deal of sense. Not to digress off the Philly question, but the Mets seemingly are on the verge of becoming what the Dodgers are in the National League. They have all that money if he gets this team, and you are going to take away from the Braves, and you're going to take away from the Phillies, and you're going to take away from the Nationals. So I think Philadelphia realized we've got to address our bullpen, and they did. Whether they added the right pieces, whether they believe that Workman is going to be super and Hembree's going to be really good, and some of the deadline day deals are going to pan out, we'll see. But to me, that team is really talented. I've been a huge Didi fan forever, on the field and off the field. And I think that they have the experience. They have the manager now. They just had been, to me, underperforming. And given the injuries that Atlanta has, especially on their staff, and you're playing Camargo and Riley, who have yet to prove that they can consistently be good. Yeah, Philadelphia, to me, is the team. I'm sure there's a little guy on my shoulder kind of tapping me saying, wait a minute, these are the Phillies. This is Joe Girardi. This is Bryce Harper. You're putting a lot of eggs in that basket. And I understand there's risk in doing that. But I think, to me, the Phillies are the team to beat in that division.
Yeah. I can absolutely see it. I mean, right now they have the 5th best playoff odds. They're behind the Dodgers, Padres, Braves, and Cubs, which right now to this point certainly have played better than them. But I definitely think the starting pitching has been great and certainly sets them up at least very well for that first 3-game kind of series. Aaron Nola has been great. Zach Wheeler has been great for them. And speaking of the Mets and, decisions of where they might spend, I'm sure that they would love to have Wheeler right now with how their starting pitching has looked with Ariel Jurado on the mound last night. But
the other part, Sarah, that we saw in his last start, and and he's a really good pitcher, is Zach Eflin decided to throw a curveball. You know, and yeah. I know that you look at all the numbers. He threw that a lot. He used it as a put away pitch. Zach Eflin, when he sort of first showed up, you were watching him, and I know we did enough. There was a time last year where Eduardo, Tim, and me, I think we did 6 Phillies games in 7 weeks. Like they were the flavor of the ESPN telecast on Wednesday night. Like, yeah, Harper's there, we're doing it. And they didn't play very well. They've gotten a lot better, but he pitched in a lot of those games, and you could see there's real pitchability there. There's strikeout stuff. There's power, but he started to throw that curveball at his last start, and it looks like a different pitcher. Hardly means that his next start, he may not give up 8, but a consistent Zach Eflin to go with Wheeler, to go with Nola, and to go with kind of an unpredictable but certainly seasoned veteran in Arrieta. Yeah, that's what I mean. You name me another staff that has those names, that has that ability. Currently, you know, Strasburg out, Soroka out, Syndergaard out. All the other teams have struggled and suffered. The Phillies haven't. They just haven't been consistent.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about, you know, with Strasburg out and that sort of, you know, conversation, the Nationals sort of pieced together a bullpen in the postseason that, one, a bunch of guys got hot at the same time, and two, they used 3 really good starters as relievers at various points in the postseason.
Exactly.
And if he's a third really good starter for them, which his, you know, his underlying stats actually say that he's been pretty good. His FIP, which is ERA without the errors your team might be making behind you, essentially, is 2.72. Right. That's really good. That hasn't happened for him before.
Right.
The curveball looked outstanding. He had more curveball strikeouts than he'd ever had in a game in that outing that you're referring to. So
right.
I definitely think the Phillies have a lot of talent there. And it's interesting, you would expect that over a longer season, talent shows out. But it's interesting that in this shortened season for them, it's like 1 month and another almost. Like they turn the page toward the end of August, and maybe hopefully now they can, you know, find their way.
And Hoskins has been great. You know, just as an aside, because we did, you were involved with our game the other night doing the stats for us. How interesting psychologically when you have somebody like Joey Votto, who's as good a hitter as we've seen in baseball, say, you know, this is why I didn't go to college, because you bring up these short seasons of 60 games versus 162. Here's a guy who has been so great. Say, this is why I didn't go to college. I knew in a 60 game season, I'd play terribly. I'd be off. Like, where does that come from? And for a lot of these guys, you know, Hoskins just being an example because he's red hot. I do think that can get into your head. Like, oh my gosh, if I don't get off to a good start in 15 games, I got 45 left. Like, I don't know if I can make, and it can kind of snowball on you. And to, you know, the Hoskins credit or other teams that have gone up and down, it's very easy to get down on yourself when you know you're, you know, as you said, you run out of time real quick. I thought that was just a real, you know, if we're going to go with this podcast being about revelatory comments, Kevin Cash is one and Joey Votto would be two. The idea that I didn't go to college because in a 60 game season, I was going to be terrible was just shocking to me. Like, wow, that's an awareness of your own vulnerabilities at the age of like 18 that I know I'm not even capable of at 55.
I mean, and it was a fascinating comment from Joey. Yeah, I don't think we get that from anyone other than Joey Votto.
No.
You know, that's so Joey Votto. But it's interesting, you know, to make that comparison with Hoskins in terms of the slow start in the short span, because the best stretch of his career to this point was basically that 2017 rookie year, and he played 50 games in that, you know? And I remember because that was one of the years we're at Williamsport while a lot of that was going on. It was the first Little League Classic. And every time I checked my phone or got ready to give you any sort of update, Hoskins had homered again. And I remember just being so like blown away by the fact that he just kept hitting those home runs. He set all the first 10 game and every other record that there was. And that wasn't 50 games. So it's interesting. You almost wonder if maybe he, especially with these last few games where he's looked better, I think he homered in 3 straight games up until last night. Maybe that kind of clicked of, you know, I've done this before and I can do this again.
Yep.
So speaking of, you know, young stars, certainly like Hoskins and others, there's a really fun thing that happened on Instagram yesterday where this highlight video of Fernando Tatis was posted up by the Las Mayores account, so the MLB account in Spanish. And Juan Soto got on there, and I think he's pretty active on Instagram, and he posted MVP, MVP, MVP as a comment. And Fernando Tatis then responded to him and put a comment in Spanish that essentially said, you know, we got to finish first and second in MVP here, regardless of who's first. We got to have one of us win it, one of our countrymen. And, you know, they're joking around for everyone to see, of course, but that really got me thinking. I mean, it seems pretty possible and realistic that these guys could finish one and two. So I was curious where you're at with the NL MVP race and, you know, what has this been from these two guys in the same season?
Right. Well, I think the great part about baseball now, and when we went to Puerto Rico and the Indians were there, you got a chance to understand Francisco Lindor, and we saw during an Indians-Cubs game the relationship that he has with Javier Baez. I think, and maybe the NBA players more recently with the social justice, you recognize the fraternity that is these guys. And then you reduce it to the country that they come from and the pride that they have. You know, and you just brought up Williamsport. When they go to Williamsport, you can see the ease in which they communicate to the Little League player. Like, they love to talk baseball. They're so passionate about the game. And when you have a countryman that is so talented, you can see the pride that they each take in that alone. You know, the flag waving from the WBC is legitimate. The Caribbean Series is so legitimate. And that was just another example of the passion of baseball and the respect between the two young guys and just how much of a sort of a fraternal brotherhood it is, A, amongst baseball players, B, amongst countrymen, C, amongst talented players. That part was really neat to see. And yeah, I mean, to me, Tatis is your MVP right now for a lot of reasons. I made the case Sunday that he's elevated Manny Machado's game just sort of by virtue of observing him day in and day out and his effort. You know, you do, to me, take the numbers, which are off the charts, but there is a magnetism about Fernando Tatis that not a lot of other players have. And it struck me like last year, like Vlad Guerrero Jr. Was that guy. and he's still that guy, but he's not that guy because Tatis is that guy this year. It's not as if the star has you know, shot out of the sky and faded, but there's no question, like Jace Tingler told us pregame last week, you can't take your eyes off him. And that's true. And that's really hard in a game of baseball to have somebody who you can't take your eyes off of. There's 18 guys on the field. You know, and to say that one stands out that much against everybody else, and he does. And, you know, so the numbers give you the MVP, but so does the magnetism, the personality, the smile, the effort, the swinging 3-0 and hitting a homer. Like, all those things add up to MVP, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a sort of watchability, desire to watch him that I think it's really impressive to be doing that on the Padres. I mean, not to ding them in any way, but it is the West Coast. We know that a lot of coverage is often, you know, just literally based in the East Coast. And we have a schedule this year where he's literally not playing outside of the Pacific time zone. So right. He is not playing a 1 o'clock game for us at any point this year. Usually you get the Padres coming to New York once or twice. You get these other things. None of that is happening. And I still feel like the average baseball fan, the collective baseball fan, whatever you want to say, is so aware of everything he's doing. It's that magnetism, everything that you're talking about.
I agree. I mean, his ability to cut through is great. And, you know, it's always been one of these television related questions that I never quite understood from a ratings perspective, other than the idea that you have these rabid fan bases on the East Coast. But why would we start World Series games at 8:40, meaning we're playing them at midnight, as you well know, which is 9 o'clock in the West Coast, prime viewing time. The ratings go way up. Why is it that guys that play in Los Angeles and San Diego don't get the attention that the guys that play in New York and Philadelphia and Washington get, when everything is geared towards that particular time zone, in a sense, on television, especially when it comes to the big national events, All-Star Game, Home Run Derby, World Series. And you've been to these places. It's easy to see why people want to live in San Diego. It really is. And Los Angeles. There are a lot of things that outweigh, especially when it comes to weather, et cetera, time zone. You know, people accuse me of having kind of an East Coast bias. And you know, when someone says, you know, where would you like to be for the World Series? Who do you root for? I root for time zones and temperatures. That's what I root for. I want to be in the West Coast or Central, and I want to be warm because we're selfishly outside after games. And I like that. So the idea that somebody like Tatis in San Diego, in a market where Tony Gwynn was often overshadowed by players in the Central and East Coast time zones, he's cutting right through it. He is absolutely making himself a household name. And you have more, you know, national programs now, MLB Network, to go with our show and all that coverage. It's easier to become a household name now than it was before. And he's absolutely inserted himself into that conversation by his style and his play.
Absolutely. I was going to say, I mean, I think social media is a big thing too. You know,
You're
on the East Coast, but you're checking Twitter at 11 p.m. You see he hit a home run. Maybe you turn on the game. Maybe you go watch the highlight, whatever it is. Certainly helps. And I also love the warm weather, though I remember it being 103 degrees at game time in the 2017 World Series in Los Angeles. And that was really fun. So that's something for us to all look forward to, potentially.
That's true. You and I have sweated together and yes. We have frozen together. Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Carl, thank you so much for doing this. This was so much fun. I really appreciate it.
Great to be on with you. Keep up the great work. We're really proud of you.
I'm so thrilled now to be joined by Mandy Bell, who covers the Indians for MLB.com. I work with her over at MLB.com. Mandy, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Sarah. How are you?
Doing well. Really excited to get to talk to you on here again. So part of why I wanted to bring you on was, you know, we're still just another day out from the trade deadline, and the Indians made one of the biggest moves. So I figured we should go through that a little bit. Obviously, the Mike Clevinger deal, we know that was the biggest name to get dealt. He went over to the Padres in a many, many player deal. So what is the most important thing to you about who they got back and how this all played out?
Yeah, I think the most important thing for the Indians always is just building up their farm system. They're just trying to constantly sustain success. They never want to enter that rebuilding phase. And so they've really mastered how to avoid that and how to continue to build that farm system up. So I think the biggest takeaway, I know some people were frustrated that the return didn't really include a huge impact player for 2020, but the Indians are excited, and Naylor and Hedges and Quantrill, who's going to be added to, or who was just added to the big league roster. But then they also have three prospects, and from the Padres side of it all, they were their 7, 9, and 11 prospects, according to MLB Pipeline. And I think the biggest excitement is shortstop Gabriel Arias, and he's got some really impressive numbers. Last year, throughout his minor league season, he really posted some eye-catching numbers, and I think that was the biggest thing for the Indians. They've had such a history with the Pirates and trading with them. Now that's three straight deadline deals, and I think that all that history helped them make this deal because they were just comfortable with their system, and they said that we have asked about every single one of these guys over our past few deals with them. And so they've all been on our radar. So I think that's the biggest takeaway, is just continuing to build for the future.
Absolutely. And I know I've talked about with Buster actually on here about how that future that they've kind of been continuously building, and especially the pitching depth, is part of what made it possible for them to make this trade. I mean, we saw the Tristan McKenzie debut. We see that they seem to every year have another young pitcher we've never heard about or haven't heard a lot about leading up to the year, all of a sudden be an impact player in that rotation. And I think that that's why you can take someone as good as Mike Clevinger and ship him out in the middle of the year and still have the playoffs in your sights. But obviously the issue, as I feel like we have, you know, discussed and found plenty of stats on throughout the year, is the offense. And it doesn't necessarily feel like this deal really addressed that for this season. So how are they feeling? How are you feeling looking at where their offense is at with, you know, the postseason less than a month away?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, the offense has been anything but consistent this year, and it's been so challenging for this team who's been gifted one of the best rotations in baseball. I mean, it's been the best rotation in baseball. And so to take away one of their biggest assets in that, to try to help bolster the team and then not really get that impact bat in return, I know that was really tough for a lot of fans to swallow during this process. And I totally get that. I know that there's been some talk of whether Naylor could help that outfield crew who's really, really struggled. But just the offense in general, Francisco Lindor year in and year out is the pulse of this lineup. And every time it seems like he has a big game and you think, okay, this is where the turnaround is, he gets a little quiet over the next few days, or he struggles more with runners in scoring position. And they just haven't been able to catch fire truly offensively, which makes it wild to think that they're still in the share of first place in the American League Central. So I think that the offense, if they can figure out a way to put something together here over the last few weeks, I think we've already seen just how much separation that they could create within the division just by getting the bats going, because they're already in first place despite their struggles, just by leaning on their elite rotation. And then if you just add some offense in, I really think that they could try to, you know, start pulling away here soon in the AL Central.
Definitely. It just feels like they have so many guys whose track records we do know, you know, with Carlos Santana, and I put Framil Reyes there, and Lindor, of course, and Jose Ramirez, where you just need to see it all working at once. And I watch them every night and I just expect it to all work. And I know they scored a bunch of runs last night, so it did work, you know, playing the Royals, obviously. But it's interesting to me because their offense and their offensive struggles are so stark, because I always have them next to the White Sox and the White Sox and the Twins. And those are the teams in the division that are obviously all almost knotted up. You know, the White Sox and the Indians are tied for first right now, and the Twins are just a game and a half behind the two of them. And those two teams are so offensively high powered that it's really interesting that you have these three teams very close doing it very differently. And if you look at the playoff odds right now, the Indians, I mean, they're all projected to make the playoffs right now. We have a lot of teams making it, obviously, but the Indians have a 44% chance to win the division. And the White Sox are at 37%. And that feels like it's been creeping up and creeping up. And I know that they've played them pretty recently, but how are you feeling about, you know, where you see the White Sox at, and what does that mean for the Indians?
I mean, I don't think there's any secret. The White Sox are really on a fun run right now, and I think this could be a magical run for them this year. Said that coming into the season, I kept saying over and over again, nobody sleep on the White Sox, because I really think that they're going to be a contender this year, even if it was a 162 game season and everything was normal. I really think that this would have been the same way. Maybe it's not all this close in September if we have a regular season, but I do think it would have been a tight race between these three teams no matter what. You saw in the offseason their desire to try to get better and want to win now, and I think that we're seeing that all come together at this point. And for this to be this close right now, it's going to be a fun final month to watch the AL Central. And I think it seems like it's been so long since people have said that. Because everything here is this division has always just been set, and the Indians ran away with it the last few years. And then the Twins came in last year, and it was like, okay, well then maybe it's not as predictable as we thought. And now that there's a true race, it could be a lot of fun. So I think that, I think the White Sox, Twins, and Indians on the final week of the season, they're all going to still be in it. I think it's going to be super, super close, and it might come down to the last few days. And I think it's going to make for some really fun baseball.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, context is almost out the window in this season with, you know, it's starting on July 23rd and everything else. But just looking at the calendar and feeling where we are, hey, it's starting to feel like fall outside. Like, it's really fun for it to be September and these three teams are still in it. You know, it's just like, especially these three teams, because I love every team in baseball. I love watching every team. I love every player. I feel like I make that pretty clear, but there's something really exciting about teams that don't necessarily always get their due. And I think that those three teams, for different reasons and in different ways, the White Sox obviously just being overshadowed by the Cubs, and the Indians and Twins maybe being in smaller markets, don't necessarily get the same treatment as other teams. So it's really cool to have all of them in it. And the fact that we're going to be talking about all of them, they all have different reasons why we can't stop talking about them. And for the Indians, one of those reasons is Shane Bieber. And I feel like, especially his first like five or six starts, every single time he pitched, I was calling Elias for you, and we were getting the most strikeouts through this many starts, the most strikeouts through that many starts. And he's not quite on there anymore, though there was a really cool stat about him having the most strikeouts through 50 innings as a starter in a season, something like that, the other night. But how much fun has it been to watch him in person when you can, and, you know, just seeing what he's been doing and really going back to the All-Star game last year, which is, I think, where most people sort of put him on the map outside of Cleveland, though it happened in Cleveland.
Absolutely. I mean, his rise has been unbelievable, but I think the biggest thing about it and what's been most enjoyable and maybe stunning to watch is the fact that he's learned so quickly how to adjust on the fly, maybe when everything's not there. The last time out, he really did labor through his last outing. And it's weird to say, because you look at the final line and it was six innings with one hit and nine strikeouts. And everyone looks at you like you're crazy to say that he was laboring. Now, the four walks in that help show it a little bit more. But I mean, he truly was. You talked to everybody afterwards and everyone was talking about the struggles that he went through to get to that point. And the fact that he's able to make the adjustments he needs to make to still be effective, no matter what is working and what's not. His curveball was off, and that's been his go-to pitch all year. And he still was able to get eight of his nine strikeouts instead on his heater and cutter. Like, he just has endless options, it seems like, if something's not working, and he just figures it out and he can grind through no matter what. And I think that's been the biggest, joy to watch this year, is just to see the maturity that he has out on the mound at such a young age, and see how quickly he's learned and thrown himself into this ace role. It's just been so unbelievable and impressive to watch. And it's truly, truly fun to watch him every time he takes the mound.
Yeah. And I just think back to, you know, what I made reference to earlier with the fact that this team just continues to trot out pitching depth. I mean, I remember when they traded Corey Kluber, and at the point when Kluber was traded, he certainly wasn't two-time Cy Young Award winner Corey Kluber, though a lot of that I think was due to injury. But you never would have guessed at that point, that day when we were working on that trade and everything else, that they were going to have a Cy Young contender this season. I certainly wasn't going to guess that. And that sort of gets me to my next question of just, you know, I know you only see, you know, the Indians and whoever they're playing at any given time. So certainly not putting you on the spot with that. But who do you think is his best sort of, you know, challenger for the American League Cy Young? Or do we already have our next, you know, Indian Cy Young Award winner here?
I mean, it's crazy, because you see writers get assigned a vote every year, and that vote is taken so seriously, as it should be. And so you start looking through these numbers and you try to take some time to figure out who's going to be the right choice to vote, especially with a Cy Young vote. You take that super seriously and you weigh out all the stats. You look into everything in depth. You take the time. But right now, if the season ended today, I don't know if it takes more than a few minutes to sit down and say, all right, well, this is pretty clearly Shane Bieber. And that's rare. It's hard, especially over just a few weeks, the way that he separated himself from the pack, as much as he has, to just be so clearly elite. It's been really unbelievable. So, I mean, if the season ended today, I think he just runs away with it. Now, it's hard to not trying to take away anything from Lance Lynn and the season that he's had, because his numbers are unbelievable as well. And it just shows even more how crazy Bieber has been this year. If you're just saying that he's a runaway candidate with the season that Lynn has had, I think that he will stay in that mix as well. And I do think that even Lucas Giolito, I think he's somebody over this last month. I think the White Sox have a really great stretch here, and I think he could be a big part of that. And so I think he could get his name into working into some votes. But Bieber's biggest challenger right now might even just be himself. I mean, if he can go out there and keep turning in the outings that he's been having over the last few weeks, I don't see how he doesn't walk away with the AL Cy Young at the end of this year.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, certainly not to take away from season Lance Lynn is having, Dallas Keuchel also having a really good year, Dylan Bundy, Kenta Maeda obviously almost threw a no-hitter a couple weeks ago now. But Shane Bieber is far and away ahead in pretty much every category. I mean, we've talked about his whiff rate. When you swing against him, you're probably going to miss. All of his strikeouts, his ERA is 1.20. His fielding independent pitching, which is essentially what your ERA should be, if not for your defense and everything else, is 1.74, which is also really low and also leading American League starters. I mean, his WAR is really high. You name it, he's far and away that number one guy. So I think it'll be really interesting. And I think it's really, really cool for the Indians to, you know, in a season where they got rid of Corey Kluber and they kind of transformed their rotation. And then maybe they kind of transformed it again a little bit, just even at the deadline, for this guy to be their steadying force and being so good. And I think putting them into the playoffs in a season where, you know, a lot of the preseason predictions, we didn't know it was going to be expanded playoffs, because obviously that happened right before the season. But I think there were people picking the Indians to potentially miss the postseason this year when it was going to be a normal format. And obviously the format changing is something, but they're having the type of season where, as it stands right now, even in a prior format, they still would have made it. And I think that he is a huge reason why there, and that just can't be overstated enough.
I completely agree with you on that.
Mandy, thank you so much for doing this. This is so much fun. We text all the time. We talk on Slack all the time. It's great to actually talk with our voices and talk about baseball. So thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely, Sarah. Thanks so much for having me.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. Questions for Sarah Langs. And I saved one for you a couple weeks ago from our pal Jason Amico. He wrote in, since Sarah Langs is going to be calling her first Major League Baseball game on air on Major League Baseball Network, how can we best integrate sabermetrics and baseball analytics into game broadcasts without overwhelming the lay fan? What say you?
Well, first of all, thank you for saving this one. I really appreciate it. It's fun to think back on that broadcast, which we did have a lot of fun. And I think the answer is that we already are, to an extent. I mean, I think certainly on the StatCast broadcast that MLB Network has done, but also that ESPN has done with Mike Petriello, Jason Benetti, and Eduardo Perez. I mean, if you watch those broadcasts, they're not overwhelming you with numbers. It isn't math class. That's something Brian Kenny said on the broadcast I did. He kept saying, this isn't math class. And it really isn't. I mean, we're just using numbers and metrics that are honestly measuring things that we've all been talking about in baseball and people have been talking about in baseball for more than 100 years. My go-to example is something like sprint speed. We always talk about, oh, that guy's fast, that guy's slow. So now we can put a number on it. You know, we're not trying to change the game in any bad way. There's no malintent. It's just, you know, let's measure things that people always talk about. So I think that the answer is sort of that it's ongoing and that part of it is almost not doing it consciously. It's just using whatever information is available to you. And, you know, all of the broadcasters who I watch are really good at making sure they have the best possible information that answers their questions. And the more and more that people look for that, the more analytics you get, you know, meshed in there.
Imagine if someone was like, that's Sarah Langs using sprint speed in the broadcast, just ruining baseball. Here she goes again.
Exactly.
I'm sure people do say that sort of stuff. Next up, Regina Wilson at Margarita Noir writes in, what are the chances the Phillies re-signed Didi Gregorius? He's come up big for them so far and is great on and off the field.
Yeah, he's been a lot of fun to watch for the Phillies. I think that his leadership is really evident. It's really great to see his tweets and, you know, learning a whole new dictionary of what every emoji corresponds to. If you don't know, he used to do these win tweets when he was at the Yankees, and there was a different emoji for every player. Now we have to relearn a different emoji for every Phillies player. I've personally really enjoyed that. But yes, he's been great for them on the field. He's definitely been a great presence. I think that's pretty palpable. I'm not sure where they're feeling exactly with re-signing him, but he certainly seems like a player who would be a really good player to target. And I'm sure that the market is going to be pretty different this offseason, especially for a guy like him who took a one-year deal with the idea of going back into the market next year, which will now be this year. So there could be some interesting competition for him for sure.
Next up, we got Ghost Runners on second at Ghost Runners One. Those guys write in, why are there players to be named later in trades? Do the teams know who those players are and do not want to disclose it? Is it a way to hammer out the details after the deadline?
So this is an interesting question because there's like one specific direct answer, at least for 2020. And I feel like a lot of times that isn't necessarily the case. These are kind of conversation points. But in 2020, one of the rules was that a player had to be in the player pool, so the 60-man player pool, in order to be traded. So my understanding is that a lot of the reason that there were so many players to be named later in the trades this year is teams looking to maybe trade someone who is not currently working out at that alternate site and figure that out a little bit after the season. As for why there are in general, I mean, I think it's just one of these things that's always happened in trades where, you know, the idea is we're going to give you somebody, but right now it's not going to be one of our impact players. It's not someone from our major league roster. So we'll figure it out at some point.
Interesting stuff. Last one for today. Tevi Troy at Tevi Troy writes in, you guys said on the podcast that the Padres have five players with an OPS over 1,000. Has any team finished a season with that many 1,000 plus OPS players? What's the record for most 1,000 plus OPS players on one team in a season?
Yeah, so this is a lot of fun. So just first off, I mean, absolutely outstanding offense by the Padres and all of these players who've been so good. Now, the way that stats work is that the Padres are not going to currently show up in any search I do as having those guys with those OPSs because they haven't done it with the Padres yet. So just looking kind of historically instead, there have been four teams in the modern era to have three players with an OPS of at least 1,000 in a season who qualified for the batting title. The 2004 Cardinals with Jim Edmonds, Albert Pujols, and Scott Rolen. 2000 Astros with Moises Alou, Jeff Bagwell, and Richard Hidalgo. 96 Mariners with Ken Griffey Jr., Edgar Martinez, and Alex Rodriguez. That's probably the one people would have guessed, I would think. And the 1929 Cubs with Rogers Hornsby, Riggs Stevenson, and Hack Wilson. So hasn't happened a whole lot. We haven't seen five. I think some of that might be some early season stuff, but there's no question this Padres offense has been outstanding. And, you know, we'll see where the stats all come out at the end of the year.
Alrighty, that does it for Bleacher Tweets for today. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please subscribe to, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Sarah, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for tagging in for Buster today.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's really, really fun. I didn't get to say thanks for having me to Buster, so I'm going to say it to you instead. And thank you to Buster for letting me fill in. I really, really appreciate the chance and I'm really honored to get the opportunity. So that's all for today. My thanks to Carl, Mandy, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.